We are into the webinar. I can see that multiple people are on. I want to say hi to Max Latimer from Australia. I have no idea what time it is over there, but I'm sure it wasn't totally convenient for you. So thanks for being on. You guys can type in chat if you're at your desktop or a laptop or your iPad, I guess. And I have multiple questions that people have sent in. And what we'll do is I'm going to talk a bit, and we'll take this as it goes. I'm going to address the questions that came in, which are very, very good, by the way. And then if you guys have anything going on in your minds as we're talking, I can see your questions on the chat, and hopefully we'll cover everything. If something occurs to you, please get it in. This is the time to do it. We're going to try to stick to an hour or so, and I think we'll just get started. Excuse me. I am a little bit under the weather, so my voice is a little risky. Hang on. Sorry about that. So basically, when I talked about sticking points, when I made this a webinar on sticking points, I was thinking mostly about my early career and how I went from being totally clueless about the entire job of being a freelancer. I knew a little bit about advertising, almost nothing about marketing, but I've out of nowhere, as I explained in my talk, and if you guys have read any of the books I have sent over to you, I've talked a lot about that early period of time, especially in the freelance manual. And for me, the main sticking points were pretty simple. It was first my identity. Who was I? When I started out, I had art room experience. I knew how to paste up. I knew how to design a little bit. And I wasn't very confident about my copy. So my first business cards actually said designer/copywriter. I learned very quickly to drop the designing because it took 10 times the amount of time to do any design than it did to write anything. And I got paid a lot less. It didn't affect my income at all to drop the designing part and just be a copywriter. And in fact, I was able to raise my prices later. But identity was a big deal for me. For me, it was pretty simple. You know, designer, not a designer, but a copywriter for sure. For you, I think a lot of you out there know you want to be a copywriter, but keep thinking about that identity. Keep thinking about who you are and how you are positioning yourself in the market out there and how people perceive you, because just being a copywriter means not very much to a lot of people. To a lot of clients out there, they don't have any idea what a copywriter is. They have a vague idea that they need some writing done, they maybe need some marketing done, but they don't know how to fit you into their world. And some of the questions address this, so we'll get more into this a little more later. But then the next thing that I had to do, my sticking point, was a work ethic. I was a slacker. It wasn't a coincidence that I got fired from most of my jobs and that I wound up sleeping on my friends' couches for about 6 months while I was living out of my car. And one of the things I had to do was just take the basic idea of business before pleasure to its furthest point. And for me, that became what I later wrote out as the professional's code, which is you are where you said you'd be when you said you'd be there, having done what you said you'd do, and be ready to do what needs to be done while you're there. So that erased a lot of the nonsense in my life that was holding me back. The whole idea of business before pleasure was astonishing to me, but it helped put me into a better position to be a freelancer. I'm not accusing anybody out there.
All attendees are muted.
Oh, I just got a noise in my ear about you guys being muted. And I lost my thought. All of you guys are probably in a position where you're trying to juggle family life, where you're trying to lead a full life, and you're trying to get your careers going, or if your career is already going, you're trying to move it to the next level. There are certain periods of time when you're changing, when you're either changing your lifestyle, you're changing your goals, you're changing where you want to be, you almost have to drop a lot of other things or have a very understanding family or spouse or girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever to understand that you're going to have to devote a lot more time to the job than you may later on. But at the period of change, you're really going to have to concentrate on what's going on. So for me, part of the identity was if I was going to be a copywriter, I was going to be a writer. And a writer writes, and a writer reads a lot. And a writer back then haunted the library. Now you would be haunting online resource sites and looking up as much data stuff as you can, finding out everything you can. You become a vacuum for any kind of information coming in. Because the best copywriters out there, the A-listers, the guys who make the big money, who are in demand, who have the best reputations, they know a lot about almost everything in regards to marketing and advertising and writing. They don't, even those that specialize, say, like Clayton, for example, kind of specializes in health and finance. But that doesn't mean he couldn't write outside of that market because he knows enough about the entire genre of advertising and marketing that he could branch out very, very easily. Specializing is good sometimes. Sometimes it's not. And we'll actually talk about that because that was a question that came up. So the next sticking point I had was just getting experience, which means finding clients. That's why those of you who have read the freelance manual know that I called it the shameless horror period, where you just take every job out there. You don't worry about getting paid. What you worry about is accepting a job, taking the responsibility to get it done, meeting your deadline, whatever it is, and dealing with other people, dealing with handing someone something you've written, and then whatever the reaction is. And if the money, if you're not trying to get high paying jobs when you first start out, you are not left with the consequences to your reputation of trying to be a $10,000, $20,000 writer, then really you should be charging maybe $500 or nothing for your stuff because you're gathering experience. This period of time doesn't have to go on very long. It can be a very short period of time, but you've got to get experience. The difference between, say, for an entrepreneur, between actually making a pitch to someone and have them pay you money and cash that check or see the money appear in your account via the merchant account, or however it is that you get money. If you get a dollar for something from someone that you've persuaded to buy something that you have, that experience changes you viscerally, changes you on the inside, changes your brain, changes the way your whole body reacts. It's like the first step in an MBA. It separates you from people who just get MBAs and never actually go out and sell anything and get that dollar from someone who has bought something. That is what we do as writers. We sell stuff. And to be able to sell very well, you do have to read a lot, but you got to put it into practice. You have to get out there and do things, which means experience. So the sticking point that gets in there for experience is, how do you find other clients? And the way you do that is by networking with other writers. For every job you get, you make sure, if you can, you get a testimonial from them if you did a good job. Even if you just wrote the menu for Uncle Hal's Deli, you know, across town for free, get a testimonial from him. Or maybe he can recommend, you know, someone to you, but tell him how to recommend you. Leave him a couple of cards. Say, hey, if you have any friends, if any of the other business guys around here need copywriting, be sure you give him my card and have him call me. I'm available, you know, 7 days a week to talk to anybody. When you start meeting other designers, when you start meeting creative directors, things like that, form relationships with these people. I had relationships early on with the guy at the copy shop where I was printing off a lot of stuff. Everyone I talked to, I let know that I was a copywriter. And if any of them knew what a copywriter was, then they might respond. They might say, "Oh, my boss was asking about a copywriter the other day," or, you know, I have a cousin who has a business who probably needs some advertising, things like that. Those kind of jobs are not too small for you to take right off the bat. I will tell you that taking a free job for me with someone like Jay Abraham, but taking free jobs, actually doing the work and telling them that, and I will explain to you how I position it in just a minute, but I would take jobs for free with no expectation of being paid. And those jobs, when recognized as being a good work, in other words, I had read a lot, I'd studied a lot, which you guys are all doing. And once you're in a position and that you know what direct response is all about. You understand the nature of advertising, the idea of saying, here's what I have, here's what it'll do for you, here's what you need to do now, which is the essence of all direct response. Once you understand that, you actually bring the answer, the solution to a mysterious problem for many, many, many business owners out there, in that they have no idea how to sell what they have. They have no idea what marketing is or what it's about, and they've certainly never heard often of direct response advertising. So, excuse me, I have to drink some more water. I'm sorry, for those of you who just chimed on, I'm a little under the weather, but trying my best to give this everything I've got. So the way you explain yourself, and this will answer, I got several questions from people asking about how to kind of break in, how to get from the raw rookie stage to the not being a rookie anymore stage. And even if you're a working writer and you're just trying to move up from being a pretty good veteran writer to a really great veteran writer, this isn't a bad thing to know. It's a good concept to have. And this is the idea of putting into your head and explain to people that even though you're taking a certain fee now or no fee at all, in 6 months or so, this same job that you're doing for them will cost them $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. But while you're gathering experience, you are willing to do it for much, much less. And you position yourself this way to help them understand the value of what they're getting. And even a rookie who understands, again, direct response, understands how marketing works, understands the concept of making a pitch, having a vehicle for someone to buy what it is you're selling, and then getting that out there, finding good audiences, lists, and audiences essentially, and then being able to reach large numbers of people with a pitch that actually explains what's going on and has a way for people to buy. This can change business owners' lives at all levels. I mean, even corporations aren't really sure how to sell on mass levels. Medium-sized businesses who rely on foot traffic, or businesses who have just thrown up a website and are doing okay, but have no idea the potential they could reach if they actually put the pedal to the metal with their marketing. If you start to understand the power of advertising, you now are the answer to a lot of problems that clients have. And this is the way to position yourself. This was a major sticking point for me as I was trying to get chutzpah and cojones to go out there and knock on the doors of advertising agencies and small to medium-sized businesses who I either knew or suspected needed some advertising, and go in there and start talking, even though I had very little experience at the time. That's how I kind of steeled myself, is I knew that I may not be a top writer, but I know enough to solve 80 to 90% of the main problems out there. And of course, this is all based on the idea that a really bad ad to a hot market can still do pretty well. So you want to write good ads, but just knowing what you know after reading all this stuff. So let's that was my idea of sticking points. They come up in different ways in the questions that I had. And I want to start off with, let's just start off with Max Latimer, who had a question from Australia. He wants to file his question under Raw Rookie. He's been studying AWAI's material for about a year and a half. The Raw Rookie stage has been chugging along, but he wanted to know if he should focus on a niche or start working his contacts and get more of what we call the shameless whore period, which is just taking on every job you can. So my recommendation, Max, and to anyone else having that same question, whether to niche yourself, in other words, specialize in one particular business or market, or try to get as much experience as possible, is that down the line, there are a number of successful writers who have stayed within a single niche and done very, very, very well. The more you know about a certain niche, whether it's health or finance or say you it's skiing, for example, or whatever the market is where you start to specialize in, you can do very, very well. However, you become kind of dependent upon the clients in that market. And as you write for them, they will get savvier and savvier. And the more they pay you, the more they will understand how to bring other writers in. They'll start nurturing other writers. The competition will get very heavy. You're almost arranging for your own exit from many of these markets, unless you are able to stay on top, which requires a lot of work, which is why guys like Clayton, who are at the top of the game, will spend 4 to 6 months on a piece. That's very, you know, that's because the competition is so high. I like getting as much experience in as many different markets as possible, because that made me the Uber freelancer. I could walk into any situation and after a couple of years and have some experience that I could bring to bear, even if it was in a market I didn't know existed yesterday, and I come and say it was aeronautics or something. I had no experience. I still understood the marketing angles of approaching a market, and I knew how to shortcut my learning curve for any market I didn't know anything about. I would interview the principals in the business. I would do some research, either at the library or online. I would ask as many people as I could who worked for the business, just get the stories about the business, get ideas of what makes it work, why people buy, why people refund, why people are unhappy, why they're happy. So I'd like to talk to customer service. I self-educated myself. So the idea of spreading yourself out into multiple markets, the learning curve becomes very, very short once you kind of figure out what you need to do. Excuse me. The first time you do it, it's going to be a little daunting. You're going to think, you won't know how long it will take you to get hip to a certain market that you didn't know anything about. So, excuse me again. But once you do it, once you understand that you can just do research, you can interview people, you can do all the things I just mentioned. Once you understand how easy that is and how quickly that makes you a minor expert in a lot of things, especially if you're interviewing the top people in the biz. If you interview the CEO, his secretary, the top salesman, the guys in the lab, the feet in the street salesman, if you interview those guys, you're going to get a better idea of what's going on than often the CEO will, or the owner of the company, because he's not interviewing those guys a lot. A lot of times they're very, very complacent, and they bring you in as a person who can thinking outside the box, bring an outsider in to look at how things are done and present ways to change their marketing around. So my vote is always for doing as much as you can. If you're in a rookie position and you're not sure what to charge, you know, as long as you have some kind of income, if you can take care of yourself for the next month, pay the rent, and do things like that, you know, you don't have to devote yourself to the jobs. Doing quickie jobs and doing them either for free or say, look, I'll tell you what, I'll do the job. You won't pay me anything up front, but please pay me 5% of whatever you think the profits were after this is done. Or tell the client, if it works, and you get to decide what work means. So if it works according to whatever definition you have of working, if it works, then pay me a couple $100 or $500, or pay me whatever you think is fair. The good thing about doing this, and you may only need to do this a couple of times before you start understanding the psychology of the client, of what the client thinks about what you're doing for them. Sometimes they're very thankful. Sometimes they think, anybody could do this, and a writer, you know, shouldn't be paid much more, and he'll give you a couple of free coupons for a dinner somewhere. So, but understanding this, starting to work with clients, starting to deal with people's expectations, with what clients do after they get your copy. You may write a brilliant ad for someone, not charge them anything on the front end. They may take it, and as often happens, they will step all over it. They'll have their daughter with the English lit degree rewrite your headline, rewrite the offer. They may drop the offer. They'll change things. and they'll take what was a pretty darn good ad and turn it into a piece of garbage, run it, and then blame you when it goes wrong, not understanding that what they did was gut the thing. So that's an important lesson to learn too. And as you learn these lessons, because you're using critical thinking as you're going, what is the lesson from dealing with this guy? What is the lesson of taking this job, meeting this deadline, of doing this? How am I forming myself into a better writer and a better freelancer, able to command the large fees? These lessons, dealing with the smallest client and dealing with the largest client, there's going to be a lot of similarities, because I've had clients pay me unconscionable amounts of money for an ad that they then stepped all over and, yes, had their daughter with the English lit degree rewrite the headline. This actually happened with some of the largest mailers in the world. It's because the psychology of people out there doesn't change dramatically from the low end to the high end. Money and income and having a successful business doesn't change the basic ideas that a lot of people have about writers, about freelancers, about how advertising works and marketing works. And you'll find this out as you go. So the whole thing is about marketing, right, and experience, excuse me. All right, let's move to another one. I see nobody's chimed in on chat, so I must be doing something right. Pam Shannon asks, she would like to know the preferred method, this is a good one, the preferred method for getting clients who have budgets large enough to get me in the six-figure range within a year. So I made some notes on this. I get this question asked a lot. How do I quickly bust into the high-paying gigs? So I don't know what level you're at, Pam, right now, but I'll answer in a kind of general way, and I'll answer your question, and then I'm going to ask a critical question. So first of all, to find the highest paying gigs, one of the best ways to do that is through your network with other writers, your network with other people in the biz, with any clients you have, combined with your own research. And what you're looking for is what we call watering holes, where the high paying clients hang out. They often hang out at seminars. At AWAI, they had the kind of market day where you could walk among people who were looking for writers and stuff. That kind of watering hole where big paying clients gather can be hard to find. But once you start doing some research, you can start figuring this out. ClickBank, for example, is a way to go find out what's up in the hot markets. I would suggest every writer here get familiar with the ranking system at ClickBank so you can see which pieces and which businesses are doing well, which are flashes in the pan, which are trending, which have been trends and are fading. You can find out a lot about this, and you can start to reverse engineer by finding out who's behind some of the best-selling stuff there, and then you find out a way to contact them, find out who else they're dealing with. Maybe you contact the people they're dealing with whatever writers, if they're in-house, if they're writing for themselves, things like that. But do that research, and you want to identify qualified prospects. One of the ways to do this when you're unknown, when your reputation is really among you and your family, they think you're great and you think you're great, but no one else does. So when you're there, one of the ways that other writers have worked into hot markets once they've tracked them down is to offer free breakdowns of their marketing with a lot of suggestions on what to do. So I know a number of A-list writers who use this tactic. They actually identified clients they wanted to work with. It might be the top guy in a certain market. You could actually do this with places like Agora. I think they're a bit immune to it, but there's no limit to who you can go to. Go to IBM. You may not reach the decision makers, but it's fun to do this kind of stuff. But find, when I say qualified clients, what we're talking about is people in your wheelhouse. If you want to deal with mid-sized clients who can afford your, 20 grand for a job, your 10 grand for a job, your 5 grand plus 5%, whatever it is your fee is, and you can start to figure that out by reading the freelance manual that I sent you, because there's a whole chapter on getting paid there. When you have the qualified prospects, get their advertising, get their emails, get on their lists, try to find as much of their advertising as possible and stay current with it, and also find out what they did before. And it's okay for you to have in your initial contact with these people, however you get through to them. And there's ideas in the freelance menu about how to break through the barriers to reach the decision makers in certain size companies. But once you do this, offer them a breakdown. Say, I saw your ad, or I saw your series of emails, or I saw your launch process last month. I thought you might want to have a nice breakdown of what I think went right and what I think may have gone sideways in this. A lot of clients react very positively to this stuff because A, it's free. B, you sound like you know what you're talking about because you've identified yourself as a freelance copywriter who understands marketing, has been studying direct response for a long time. And if they're good businessmen, they're always going to be open to somebody's ideas on stuff. And they love to get stuff for free. So break it down. Spend a couple of pages and just say, you know, here's what you did. Here's where it might have gone wrong. Here's what I would have done. Have you tried this? You know, have you tried autoresponder series that last longer than a week? Have you tried having 15 emails in your autoresponder series instead of just one? Have you tried raising your price? Have you tried lowering the price? Have you tried having multiple options and payment options and things like this? All the stuff you learn as you read and you hang out with other writers and you follow other people's stuff, you may go to, you know, if I was doing this myself, I would find the guy or the company I was going to go after, and then I would check out what they've done. Then I'd check out what all the competition had done, and I would try to find out as much as I could by research where they were in relationship to each other, how hard the competition was. And I may want to work for the guy who isn't number one, but I'll find out what the guys who are number one are doing. And then in my initial breakdown of what number two is doing, I can say, did you know that number one is doing X, is doing everything you're not doing in this particular field, is positioning themselves this way, which you very much are not, et cetera, et cetera. So by doing this, you take, you know, a lot of rookies think, I don't really know much because I don't have a lot of experience and I can't write a piece like the A-listers, and you feel kind of down on yourself because you haven't reached that peak where you want to be. There's room for almost every level of writer out there. Actually, there is definitely room for every writer out there. There are jobs out there for writers who maybe are doing their second or first or third job because you've studied direct response and you know enough to be able to understand you need a headline, you need to explain what's going on, you need to have a vehicle for having the prospect respond to become a customer. You understand the basics of this stuff. So by bringing this, you understand how to start breaking down what other people are doing. And looking at even someone who spent a lot of money, say on a launch or an ad that they're running or a web page, they may not understand that their link is broken to their buy page. They may not be checking it regularly. They may not understand there's 50 typos in the middle of the thing. They may not understand that they're using 5-year-old video technology. They may not understand a lot of things, but comparing things and bringing all this to the table makes you a valuable person and you get on their radar that way. And I hope that makes sense to everybody. Let's see. The top markets out there are health, finance, the PUA market, if anybody's been following around on that. A lot of B2B is out there. And, you know, tracking Kickstarter campaigns, for example, finding out where the new things are going on, getting on social media like Facebook and finding out who's advertising on Facebook and then start tracking them, find out what they're doing, get on their list and find out if they need help, if they're doing part of it right. A lot of people in AdWords, for example, they'll spend a lot of money in AdWords and then what they don't spend money on is the writers. And so their AdWords don't work. So they say, yeah, we tried AdWords, it doesn't work. Well, the writing didn't work. And you can actually explain to people why that didn't work. Also, I think sometimes when you're talking about getting into the six-figure range or things like that, that's kind of the wrong question to ask. Because if you've looked at high paid A-list copywriters and say, I want that kind of income, and you haven't looked further than that, then you need to have a reality check, because the lifestyle of an A-list writer may not appeal to you. They're spending a lot of time just writing. It's them in a dank garret somewhere, although it could be a very fancy high-priced garret, but they're writing. It's them and the screen and their stacks of research and the phone, and when they pick up the phone, they're actually talking about the job with somebody, and they're working very hard. Some of those A-list jobs take 2 to 6 months to do. It's a lot of work, and a lot's riding on it, because if you don't get the control, you can write a brilliant piece and get aced out by somebody who was competing against you for the control because they had a more clever buy option, or they used some gimmick or something that aced you out. So it's a very, very dog-eat-dog market, a dog-eat-dog world in a lot of these markets. I try to tell writers who are trying to break into the big money is to find the medium-sized businesses that are doing a lot of money, can afford to pay you what you're worth, and put you on some kind of royalty plus retainer plus a percentage, so that you get very clearly every ad you write pays you after you've written it. As I said at the seminar, I'm still getting paid for ads I wrote 20 years ago because I wrote them on a 5% royalty basis. The ads did so well and are still doing well. They did well in direct mail. They did well in print. They moved easily online, and they're working as VSLs right now with very, very few changes. The only changes are on the ordering instructions because it's different in those different vehicles. Often, writers that struggle for a long time, for years, will break the six-figure barrier with a single client that has a single hit with a single ad they wrote that brings in that percentage. So 5% of, you know, an ad that does $10,000 ain't much, but 5% of an ad that gets a couple of million dollars in, then you're starting to talk about some big money. So the right question to ask is not, how do I start making this money, but what is it that attracts you to, excuse me, the various parts of the freelancing world? I'm going to take a drink of water. I really apologize for this. I'm a little stuffed up. the lifestyle of a writer who isn't going after the A-list stuff is a lot more definable to people, and a lot more understandable to people who want to get into freelancing, because you can do the jobs sometimes in a weekend. I've written ads overnight, or I've changed just a few things during a consultation call and then wrote a new headline that completely transformed the marketing and advertising for the client, and did everything that needed to be done for the fee they were paying me. So I'm in and out very, very shortly. They may have something for me next month, next week, maybe 6 months from now, but I'm on the radar. I'm the guy who helped them, and I wrote something. It didn't take me months to write. And once you have relationships with clients too, the second ad is much easier to write than the first one for similar products, because you've already done the major research. So the third one and the fourth one is even easier to write, because you now have feedback from the first couple of ads of what worked, what didn't work, what needed to be massaged, what hooks worked, what didn't, as you start to learn things. So developing relationships with clients who are able and willing to pay you the money that you're worth. And 5% of a deal, 5% of gross, by the way, not net, and that's explained in the freelance course, makes you kind of a partner in the business. But as the writer, even if you're a freelancer and you're never going to join the business, you're not going to be on the masthead, you're going to get paid separately as an independent contractor, but you still are a partner in that, because without you, or without someone like you, or without a writer that can make it work, their stuff won't work. As I say over and over again, the marketing graveyard is crammed with superior products that failed because nobody figured out how to sell them. And inferior products became the standard because they knew marketing. So a lot of clients are in that position, and you can bring real magic to their lives. And I really like dealing with entrepreneurs. I worked in the A-list field for a long time. I was one of the first writers are back in the 80s. I worked with Ogora back in the 80s. I worked with Phillips, worked with Boardroom. I worked with a lot of these people, and I accepted how much work had to go into these jobs. I did it. And then when my eventual best friend and business partner, Gary Halbert, came along, he didn't want to deal with those guys. He wanted to go off and deal with entrepreneurs. And I thought, this is more fun. I had more fun dealing with entrepreneurs, and my income skyrocketed at that point. The first year, in fact, I left the A-list writing jobs and went off into the entrepreneur jobs, small writing for everybody from a dentist to a people putting on conferences to people that own 50 auto supply stores. To write for those guys meant that I could write very quickly. They didn't mind paying the fees that we had. They would let us in on the back end, and we had relationships. I always dealt with the guy who signed the checks, which was very important to me, which you won't be doing. You'll be dealing with committees when you deal with larger corporate clients. And I could get money coming in within the month because they were very eager to get going. There wasn't a long approval process they had to go through. At most, they may run it by their lawyer. But if the lawyer knew anything about direct response, and I would deal with that, I would talk to the lawyer. Whereas in some corporations, you'll deal with a room full of lawyers who hate each other and know that saying no will never get them in trouble, so they very rarely say yes. That can cause you all kinds of problems, and you got to understand the politics that goes on in the back rooms. You got to understand how the guy who says yes, you may never meet him. There's all kinds of hierarchies going on in politics. For some people, that's great. They love it. And I did like it, and I was actually pretty good at it for a long time. But I really like dealing with entrepreneurs. So the question for me was, the lifestyle mattered. The prestige of being an A-list writer didn't really mean much to me. So I turned my back on a very high-powered career as an A-lister. I just walked away from it and went into dealing with entrepreneurs, and had a different kind of reputation, which eventually has brought me around full circle, so that I, go out to Florida, hang out with Mark Ford and some of my best friends, like David Deutsch, one of the top A-list writers in the game, Paris Lampopoulos, another top guy. So I'm still friends with these guys, but I prefer the entrepreneur world. So I hope that answers the question. For me, you have to understand the lifestyle versus the money versus the reputation versus why you're in the game to begin with. And I hope that answers people's questions. And please chime in, folks, if I'm not answering your question or if you feel there is something else you'd like to know about this. Let's move to Carol Parks.
Let me just make sure, John, just interrupt you for a moment here. As far as chime in, there's a couple ways you can do that. If everyone who is logged into some type of device, in the lower left side of your screen, there's a little message box. So if you have any questions or comments, John and I will see those if you type them in. There's also at the top center of your screen, there's a raise hand button. So if there's something that is just too long to type, if you do that, we'll see that. And then time allowing at the end, we can unmute your device, assuming you have a microphone, and John can take your question. For you folks on the phone, I apologize. I have looked upside downside. I don't know any way for you to do either of those things. Clearly you can't chat, and I've searched everywhere to see if there's any combination of keys that effectively raise your hand, and I'm sorry, there just doesn't appear to be. So this offers only for the folks that are on a PC or some type of tablet where they can type in. All right, John, there you go. You had a little break. Hope you got a glass of water, and you're back.
And, I'm glad Stan chimed in, because Stan, for me, I am very much a right brain, introverted, night owl writer. I like to write. I live to write. I like to stay up late. My lifestyle matters to me. Wearing a tie and going into an office every day is not my bag. And being able, that's why the freelance world just more or less saved my life. However, when I got deeper and deeper into business and became a consultant, as well as a writer, I needed another side to this. And I've known Stan for a very, very long time. He is much more technically adept. He actually has written code before. He's worked with people on software. He's worked with Stan, I hope I get this right, Wells Fargo, Starbucks, NATO over in Europe. He's consulted with some very, very high-powered clients before. And he also really enjoyed coming into the entrepreneur world. So we've been partners for many, many years. And he and I are like a yin and yang approaching any marketing thing. Where I fail is with the highly technical aspects. Stan shines at that. And where I shine is the creative aspect. However, Stan is also a very creative guy. And through the years of him pummeling me with this stuff, I do know a little bit about how the technical side of this works. Before I brought him on, I had one of the first marketing websites up in 2002. I had an early merchant account. I started posting stuff, and I had one of the first marketing blogs. I had one of the first podcasts in iTunes on marketing. I was an early adopter of a lot of things. I did them not very well, but I did them, and they got responses. And back then, you could have a sloppy website and still get a lot of things going on. Now we're much more adept and a fully grown up business. And I just wanted to give Stan some kudos there, and also say that as you guys network, if you could network with someone who fills in the gaps in your skill set, in your knowledge base, then do that very much. Most of the writers that I know that are getting paid the big bucks don't work alone. They have anybody from, they may have a little crew of assistants or research people. A lot of writers have other writers they work with. I frequently work with other writers, split the deal up. I come up with the big ideas. They do the hard work of the detailed writing. Find out, you know, what kind of partnership might work with you. And meeting people at these events, maybe as you go to other events, as you chime in on boards around the place in the Insiders Club, there's a lot of people being very active on the in the clubhouse, getting to know them, getting to understand them, getting to, you know, set up partnerships. You don't need to make it an official partnership. You can just start to help each other. But I will tell you, there aren't very many top writers out there that try to go it completely alone. They have little networks. I can pick up the phone and call 50 people that know different things that I need to know that I don't want to learn, and I can call them up and get a short little tutorial on it very quickly from these people. So, okay, so let's go to Carol Parks. She wants to know, how do you go from a B-plus copywriter to an A-level and be successful with those clients? Very, very key point there. Are there unique tricks to working with these clients besides busting your butt and being very respectful of their time? On a related note, are specs worth the time and effort? And I hope I answered that to a degree as far as the spec thing. Sometimes they are. A spec job is means you write on the idea that you're writing for free and you'll get paid if it works. I don't recommend that for an established writer. If you're a B-plus copywriter now, Carol, probably spec work is not your best use of your time. But to get to the A-level that I was talking about, and the A-level are the guys who write for the largest mailers, the largest publishers in the world. I will tell you that I have helped a number of writers break into the A-list game. And my first piece of advice to them is a caution, to be careful. You often get one shot. You don't get to go into a place like Agora or a Boardroom and screw it up and get another shot. And I had writers who, because they were associated with me, because they had written with me, have been contacted by some of the A-list clients. And the writer called me and said, should I take it? And I told them flat out, no, you're not ready. You're going to blow it because you've never done a job that takes 2 to 6 months to write. You haven't gone through this process of working with a hierarchy of VPs of marketing and creative directors and all kinds of people who aren't going to sign your paycheck, but whose job depends on them forcing you to toe the company line or to do the kind of work they expect. So there's a learning process that goes on. That said, if your reputation gets to the point where you understand deadlines, you have testimonials from clients, your name is out there a little bit, and you're contacted, and you're ready to go, and you feel you can write, you feel you have done jobs that have required that 110% effort, that it will take, you know, 100 rewrites of a headline, that will take 50 rewrites of the final draft, that will withstand the scrutiny of lawyers and rooms full of people who want to tear everything apart. If you think you're ready for that, you will probably be approached rather than go and approach them. So first, if you are asked, please go through this very heavy critical thinking about whether you're ready or not. If you are, then go for it. If you have a good network, you may have a writer. Like if you took a job, Carol, with an A-level client, while you're still in my mentoring program, you know, you'd be able to ask me some questions. I hope you have other contacts with other writers. It almost always pays to not be the total newbie in the room, to have been able to talk to other people who have gone through this process, to have some idea what's going on, so you're not like walking down a blind alley with dollar bills sticking out of your pocket, you know, with no idea what's going to happen next. So through your network of colleagues, they can recommend you. They can say, hey, did you know there's a job opening at blank company? Or they may bring you in because they've got too much work they can't handle. They want somebody they can trust, and you're the person they trust for whatever reason. So a lot of this has to do with the networking. And if it sounds like it takes a while to build the network, it does. It's both the professional side and the personal side. You have to get along with people. This is why we say, we're only half joking, but at the seminars, a lot of the business that gets done where the money exchanges hands is in the bar, either late at night. You don't have to drink, but that bar is where a lot of people hang out, and that's where the real conversations take place. That's where the real friendships are made. That's where the bonding goes in. That's where the real high core information is exchanged. That's where things start to really move. And this is because so much of the network belongs on relationship levels, how you deal with other people. And I'm telling you, I'm an introvert. I'm a night owl. I'm kind of surly at times, although really I'm not the total curmudgeon a lot of people think I am. I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of close friends, and I understand. But I had to study relationships. So one of the things you want to read, folks, is, and I mentioned this in a lot of the books, how to win friends and influence people and become that person who listens to others, who is agreeable, who doesn't try to be all opinionated all the time, and just go out there as a spy in the world. You're trying to get information. You're trying to learn about things. You're using empathy to understand other people's situations. Because a lot of the people in my network have only talked to me or at me. They really don't know much about me, yet they think we're friends because I listen so well and I understand them. And I understand them so well, they think I must understand him as well as he understands me, and they don't. So understand that part of it. Now, to get into the A level, you got to study these markets. You have to be getting all of the mail, all of the email. You got to be obsessively watching their VSLs critically. You want to know when a new VSL, a new ad, a new piece of marketing shows up. You want to study their launch processes from the inside by joining them. You need to immerse yourself. You need to go full native on this and become a junkie in whatever that market is that client you're after is going to go on. So that if you don't get recommended, or if the recommendation is kind of vague, just, hey, call Bob. He'll talk to you on my recommendation. Or you call Bob at the company and want to introduce yourself as a writer and say, if you need writers, I'm a freelance writer, I understand things. You can then have a good conversation with them about what's going on. You can say, yeah, I followed your launch last month, and I was very impressed with the VSLs you were doing. I thought it was interesting that you lowered the price at week three, blah, 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 things like that. That goes a long way towards letting a guy know that you're savvy, that you understand the game, that you're at least competent enough to understand what's important, what's not important, and what's going on. So that may raise you a little bit and to be able to get a job. They may throw you a bone. They may ask you to do some stuff. My first jobs working with the big mailers back in the 80s was as the fulfillment guy. Gary Benzavinga would write a piece and he would say, get this free book on, you know, the financial doom coming around the corner if the Ruskies, you know, grain harvest fails, something like that. And then I would write that book. And I would write the other fulfillment, the short reports, the bonus reports, all of this stuff. And I did that for a number of other people. And through that, doing a really good job on that, all the research, by the way, and all they had was the title and the idea, and I would do everything else. After that, I got booted up into being a ghostwriter for these people. I started ghostwriting for guys like Jim Rutz, who is the godfather of the Magalog. And, you know, under their tutelage doing that, and the clients didn't even know I was doing the ghostwriting at first. Jim would pay me direct. I would do the ghostwriting. He would present it as his, and he would get the big money, and I'd get the small money, but boy, did I learn a lot. So by the time they found out who I was, the job offers wouldn't stop coming in. I actually had to hold up my hand and said, stop, I'm not going to take these jobs anymore. I'm going off with Halbert into the wild and woolly world of entrepreneurs. So, okay, as far as spec jobs, just to get back on, I'm looking at my notes now, Carol. There are ways to take spec jobs, which is that the percentage or the chances of you getting paid start to get very, very high. In other words, you know the game, you know you can write an ad that's going to work, and you have some way of being able to check their books or check with them or, you know, talk with their accountant or find out if the stuff worked. If you trust the client, my client that I wrote all those pieces 20 years ago, they're still working. After a while, I didn't take any up front because I knew the 5% I was going to get was going to be enough. And I had so many ads going with the checks they were writing me every month were bigger than any single job I would have taken from anyone else. And asking them to come up with another $5,000 to do a job just seemed gratuitous because they would mail fast. They would get into the print magazines very quickly, and I would be getting more of that 5% by the end of the month, often if I wrote. So those were essentially spec jobs, but they were on a high trust basis, and I knew that I was going to win. And they were pitting a lot of writers against me. I was knocking off ad agencies, other copywriters. I knew they were doing this, but it, you know, I knew the market so well at that time that it didn't matter. All of your careers going from B plus to A minus to A plus, however you want to figure it out, it's a level by level career. You don't break into the A list just because you think you're ready. It's kind of a process. You're being vetted all the time if you're visible out there with what you're doing. If you're working with so-and-so and so-and-so lets it be known that you're the writer working with them, or you let people know, or you're a frequent commenter on blogs that are read by the clients you're after, or you're highly involved in social media and you're commenting on a lot of people's stuff, and writers get to know your name and things go out, your reputation will get out there. But again, you usually don't jump from being a rookie to being an A-list writer. I know of no one who's done that. Experience is the big bugaboo, and that's the sticking point that a lot of people have. Get the experience. Don't begrudge it. It will go by fast. For me, it was about a year of painful learning, another year of fun learning, but still not where I was. And after about 3 or 4 years, I was, you know, being, you know, nursed into the A-list writers. But I devoted myself to it, and you know, all of my time was spent researching, writing, fulfilling jobs, taking on jobs, dealing with clients. It was just, that was my life for a while. After that, I turned into the guy who worked for, you know, 6 to 9 months a year and took off 3 to 6 months and went and did something else. And then I became the guy who worked maybe 20 hours a week. And it wasn't until I became a guru that I started working big hours again. And lately I've gotten back to just, you know, working when I went to work, and because you know how to massage the things that need to be done. You do things in very short bursts. You become much more productive. I can get more done in 2 hours in a day as a writer than most writers of any level can get done in a week. And that's only because I know the productivity hacks. So, okay, that's the answer to Carol. I hope that did it. I'm going to take 1 second and read a couple of posts here. Okay, Max. Max asked, how do I actually know if the words I'm putting down are any good? How do you know when you're actually writing good copy? That's a, you know, the good thing about advertising as opposed to, say, writing fiction is that when you write fiction, you don't know if it's good. Bad fiction can sell, but bad advertising doesn't always sell. So if you're writing ads for something and it works, then even if you weren't happy with the headline or you think you're a sloppy writer, that doesn't matter. Some of the top guys are very sloppy writers. There are writers who are very, very good writers. There are writers who are very good writers who become copywriters, and their pieces glisten. These are the guys like me, like Clayton, like Paris, like David Deutsch, whose stuff reads like a novel. It's so great. But there are other people who aren't writers who become copywriters who are very good marketers, and they compete with the A-listers. They're up there getting the big gigs. So they are writers second. They are marketers and advertisers first. And their writing may not be the best in the world. It won't stand up against somebody who's judging them on the quality of their writing, but on the quality of the salesmanship that goes in there, it's sterling. So understand that being a top writer isn't always about understanding verbs and conjunctions and all that stuff. I actually flunked English, so I'm a self-educated writer. But it's not always about that high readability. It's about salesmanship when you're in this game. So never don't understand that. So Max, the answer is you need more experience. As you start to get experience, you will see that piece worked, that piece didn't. Okay, why didn't it work? Why did this work? What's the differences? Do clients like my writing? Do they not like my writing? And then in your network, have other writers read your stuff. Find some other writers and have them, you know, you have a critique with me. So use that carefully. Don't use that capriciously. But when you want to, send it by me and you'll get a critique by me. And you may want to find a way to get more critiques from me, or you want to find a way to have other writers critique your stuff. But writers hanging out with other writers is one of the best things you can do. Now, Jennifer Leary says, let's see if she has a question. Oh, okay. So she's talking about, it's not really a question. So Jennifer, okay. And we're coming up on the hour, folks. So I do have one other question I wanted to get to by John Belkowich. He has two questions. And first question is, where do you draw the line between freelance copywriter and marketing consultant? And folks, this was actually the subject of my speech at AWAI last year. And basically I said, most copywriters are essentially vendors. They show up and the client says, I need an ad or I need a series of emails, and I need writing for my launch, or I need a new website up. And they will tell you what they want. They will tell you what the price is, what the product is. They will give you everything you need to know. And I call it a vendor because you're pretty much like the guy who just turns the client's ideas into words that are more palatable to the market. So you're going to get paid like a vendor then. You're probably going to get paid on a 30 to 60 day schedule. You're not going to be able to dictate your fees. You're going to say, you know, the guy will say, I have a job, I'm going to pay $5,000 and I need a series of emails, and you're going to help me with the launch and blah. He'll outline it. So you do what they say. Nothing wrong with that. Probably the majority of writers make a very good living doing that. When you move up to the next level, then you become a marketing consultant who also writes. So that one of the things you do is you are able to sit down with the client and say, that's a ridiculous offer. You know that, don't you? And you may even get involved with the product. You may say, this product needs a lot of other stuff, or what about your back end? And you may help them create the back end, the secondary products that they sell where the real money is. They may need help on pricing. on they may be doing some stuff that is hurting them on the bottom line that they don't even know about. So the first step is you consult with them, and you tell, and you all of the experience you have comes to bear, and this is where you're actually doing like a hot seat with them, and you're actually helping them design the rolling out of this product and how it's going to work. Even if they've done it before, even if they've done something else with you, it's going to be a little different than any other writer they've worked with. These are the guys that get paid the big bucks. These are the guys that get paid the percentages. These are the guys who don't get their writing stepped on, because they will put it into an agreement or a contract that even if the client wants to change what you've written, they will have to test what you've written, as long as it meets legal requirements. They will have to test what you've written against their changes, and we'll let the market decide. And this is where you start to be able to dictate where things, how things happen and where things go with the marketing, with clients and things like that. So yeah, there is a very definite line between a freelance copywriter who is what I call a vendor, who is essentially this like a plumber who comes in and fixes the pipes. You're fixing the marketing pipes, and you can't say we should put the bathroom elsewhere, or we should tear the house down and start over, or you should have a different kind of bathroom set up. No, you don't get to do that. You come in, you fix what they want you to fix. And then the consultant comes in and is much more involved. You're essentially, because you're getting a piece of the action, you're essentially a partner for the duration of that project. The second question he has is, how much, if at all, does media delivery mechanisms change your approach to writing? And he's talking about the narrative flow and stuff like this. Very good question. Great question to end this on. And I have a couple of notes here. So my first answer to that, how much does the way my copy is delivered change depending on whether it's a VSL, whether it's print, whether it's going to be in a podcast or whatever? And my answer is basically it doesn't change much at all, except using, say, on a VSL, the conversational voice options. So in a written piece, I may use an ellipsis, the dot, 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 for a pause. If I'm speaking, I will just pause. I can take deep breaths or sighs or any of the other verbal cues you can use in conversation that don't translate well to the written word. So I've been experimenting with this a long time, and I will often end sentences right in the middle with a dot, 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 and ellipses, begin a new paragraph with a dot, 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 continue my thought. That gives them a visual pause, which would be, if I was speaking, a pause, and I might use dashes for a sigh, or I may even write in parentheses or brackets, eye roll, or, you know, have to explain to them in parentheses, if you don't understand, I'm being snarky here, I need to explain it, or, you know, and actually writing, I used to be against emojis, but increasingly now, especially in places like the social media universe, where words matter, and even in AdWords, I guess I don't know if I've seen AdWords with emojis, but you know they could be used, especially as the language of emojis evolves into being much more complex than it used to be with a sad face or a happy face. So I do use emojis now every once in a while. Sometimes just the typewritten thing, colon, dash, and the parentheses for a smile, or sometimes it'll get translated into an actual emoji. But things like whispering, emphasis, yelling, things like that, much better done with VSLs. And if you are going to write a manuscript that's going to be a VSL and you don't get to make the VSL, you should do a recording of your manuscript to make sure they understand where the pauses are, where the emphasis is. Because otherwise, you're going to rely on them understanding that when you bold or bold italic a word or underline a phrase, that's emphasis. A lot of people don't necessarily understand that. And if someone else is going to be reading your stuff into a VSL, they may not understand that. In the written stuff, I use visual space much more. I've shortened my sentences over the year online. I use a lot of bullets and bullet type writing, which means very boxed or categorized stuff, little boxes, little case studies, little things that are going along to make it visually pleasing and also keep the eyes moving down so that someone looking at a web page, the natural response when they reach the bottom of the screen page is to scroll down or keep going because there's no place to stop. Back in the good old days of direct mail, we used to actually plan for the sentences always ending on the next page. So at the bottom of page one, I would never, ever, ever end with a period. Whatever the last sentence was would have to go to the next page. So they would have to physically turn the page over to continue reading or go to the next page if it was just printed one side. This is a tactic that old direct mail guys have that new writers don't necessarily understand. And it's the visceral, physical handling of what you're reading. Online, we tend to lose track of, they got their finger hovering over the mouse. They can scroll, they can enlarge, they can do all kinds of things. So they're still skimming, they're still doing things. So by capturing their attention and moving them physically, moving their eyes down the line so that they scroll, this is something that's very good. Doesn't always translate into written manuscripts, say in direct mail because of space limitations, because it can cost a lot more to mail a 20-page letter than it does an 8-page letter. But these are minor things. So basically, I have always written as I would talk if I could edit as I talk. So that is not my line. That's a line that goes back to the 30s, I think. And it's the idea that when I can sit down and write something, I'm a clever SOB. I can make you laugh. The words seem perfect. But I've spent a lot of time editing that. So I will write stuff. I'll go back. I'll edit obsessively. I'm rewriting. I'm changing things around. And once it's fine, then I let it go. However, it is still in a conversational mode, always in a conversational mode to join the conversation going on in the prospect's head. And just being able to edit it just makes it a little easier to do because we can get sloppy when we write. And we often start writing rather than thinking about the conversation you're having with your prospect. So there you go. I was going to award another phone call to someone based on participation. I'll have to do it on the nature of the questions and what people wrote to me. And I'm going to award this to Carol Parks. She had a lot of was that applause, Stan, in the background?
Yes, it was.
I really like the way Carol phrased her questions. I believe I met you, Carol, at the event. I'm not sure, but I believe this will be a second hour for you. So. Appreciate all of you putting in all the time that you did. And we will have another call in December. We're going to try to make it way before Christmas, mid-month. We have to jockey around some travel plans for me and for Stan. We will give you plenty of notice. I'm seeing no more chat messages, so I assume you're all ecstatic about the information I gave you. The next one was going to be this one was about sticking points, which turned into a lot about writing. So the next one was going to be about making your career Zoom. So what we'll probably do is I will play with that question a little bit, and we'll probably continue with a lot of this stuff. Make sure you read a lot of the information I sent over, certainly the freelance manual, the SWS, get into that, all of the stuff, and think about the questions you might have next time. That can really help you. Let's think about putting the pedal to the metal on the next mentoring call so that you have actionable stuff you can do. This one was kind of getting centered, getting to a point where you can launch yourself. Now let's think about in the next one actual actionable things that you can do. Think about the questions of what do I do next? Think about a client you have. We can talk about a client you had or a job you had that went wrong or that went right, and we can think about ways to deconstruct it and do it differently, do it better, things like that. So I'll see you guys on the next call in December. We don't have a day yet. And have a great Thanksgiving for those of you in the States and for Max in Australia. I don't know what the heck you do around that time, but I think you do take some time off. So I sure love Australia. Stan and I have been there multiple times, and I've been there a few more on my own. So that's about it, guys. Thank you very much. Thank you, Stan, for hosting this. And we'll see you next month. Cheers, guys.